You're listening to the Transnational Black Feminisms Podcast, co-hosted by Tammy Navarro and Premila Nadison at the Center for the Study of Social Difference at Columbia University and Barnard College.
Hi, I'm Tammy Navarro, the co-director of the Transnational Black Feminisms Working Group at Columbia University, and I am here today to have a conversation with Dr. Abosidi George, who is a Tau Associate Professor of History and Africana Studies at Barnard College. Hi, Abosidi.
Hello, hello, Tammy.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really glad to be talking to you. So this is an opportunity, the both of us, we've been in this working group for some time together, and it's really an opportunity for all of us to learn a little bit more about your important work. So I thought maybe a nice place to start would be to ask you how you see your work fitting into these broader themes of transnationalism, Black feminism, and what you see as the maybe point of connection that jumps to your mind immediately.
A big point of connection is through my research, really. Both my research and my experience, my personal experience. And, you know, my research right now is a study of my migrant communities in 19th century Lagos going into the 20th century, and also their migrations to Lagos from various regions of West Africa, and then from the Caribbean and from South America as well. And so I think that that research is related to what the Transnational Feminism Group is interested in through the transnationality of it all, and thinking about kind of relationships between these multiple sites of the world that we tend to be introduced to as being discrete sites. And I think also because I'm looking at it from the 19th century, that, you know, the way we think about the spaces that the people were coming from or that we come from was quite different there, because in that period there were many more empires than there are in our age, which is more like the nation state dominated model. And so what does it mean to, you know, for people to be circulating within an empire is different from like crossing borders into the different nation states. And it also maybe shapes the way that they see their being in relationship with people who live in other places. And I feel like the Transnational Black Feminism Group, you know, a lot of what informs that politics is like a politics of relationship. Like, even though we're not in the same like actual city, town, village, place, whatever, we see ourselves as being in a community of interest, or a community of political interest, or a community of solidarity, one that is intentionally sought out and one that is intentionally maintained by these Black feminists moving, you know, through the world.
That's useful. Thank you. That's also one of the things that I have found the most rewarding about this group and the opportunity to have conversations with colleagues in this way. I have two questions, and I'm debating which one to ask you first. I think I will continue on the tack of your work, because I'm really interested. I'm thinking here of your book, Making Modern Girls, and I'm really interested in this theory you present us with about the kind of various availability and inavailability of categories like girlhood, like childhood, to different groups, right? Inflected, of course, by race, by position, by all the different markers of identity. So I would love to just hear you talk a little bit about the kind of flexibility you describe around something like girlhood, right? Who gets to be a girl, in what ways, who doesn't?
Yeah. I think it's really, because the Making Modern Girls was a book looking at really early to mid 20th century in Lagos, and looking at the deployments of the concept of girlhood in Lagos by social reformers, African social reformers, Nigerian women, usually upper class Nigerian women, as well as British social reform workers, like colonial welfare officials, who obviously have some, who had some, things in common, interests in common, mm-hmm. in like social development, social welfare, social organizing, etc. And the book was interested in how working class girls, girls who work in the street in various kinds of ways, but generally kind of working class girls become like the focus of their attentions, mm-hmm. and how what results from becoming the focus, being made into the focus of the attentions of people who are have higher levels of power than you do, mm-hmm. And girlhood and the concept of girlhood is one that was deployed I called it save the salvation, like a salvationist project at the time, but partly to try to in their views, save them from various kinds of urban perils mm-hmm. of like a World War II colonial port city, you know, sexual peril, peril against violence, various kinds of perils. And so, you know, the idea was that, you know, these exposure to these kinds of perils is antithetical to a vision of girlhood that these reformers and official colonial welfare officials wanted to bring working class girls into. Mm-hmm. So in the book, I suppose I had a kind of a complicated view of the kind of the salvationist project in general. Mm-hmm. Like it has some like material grounds, but it is also one that is like enacted through a hierarchical relationship mm-hmm. between the or beneficiaries, so to speak, which would be the girls. And
that's such interesting phrasing, beneficiaries, the recipients of all this care, of all this
there's a
surveillance,
care, certain kind of care, and you know, and the deliverers, the people who are delivering the care and salvation. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, I think, is that, you know, I've talked about the ideas in the book on several occasions, and it's interesting to think about how, on the flip side, there is also the politics of like a denial of girlhood or denial of childhood mm-hmm. that was, that was just kind of normalized in a kind of colonial vision of the world and the peoples of the world. And colonized people were, you know, they were raced, but they were gendered, but they didn't really have life stages. You know, they were just kind of either a generic boy, you know, if they were male, which is not necessarily a reference to age. It's more a reference to like age-based seniority, juniority, but like status in the colonial system, right? Mm-hmm. So
in the way a 60-year-old man would be a boy.
Exactly. Uh-huh. Right. And that depends on your status within the colonial hierarchy more than anything actually to do with your life stage. Mm-hmm. And so there's, you know, actually the period that I'm looking at, it's a period of like a shift, like a shift in that kind of mentality and like colonial training. And but what obtains like before that, and what we can see coming in again after that, there's also a kind of a parallel thread, I suppose I could say, of the denial of girlhood or childhood, or the denial of having differentiated life stages and therefore being, you know, fully, you know, evolving as a human, to colonized and also racialized people in the world. So, so those, you know, and I think that in discussing the book after the book has come out and in trying to think about, you know, how do some of the themes of the book relate to our like late 20th century, 21st century period, or how do they relate to maybe other societies like settler colonies, and the strength of the denial of girlhood track, or the denial of childhood track, I think is more apparent in those cases.
Absolutely. I mean, what you're saying right now reminds me of another group member's work, Donna Ian Davis. So I was just rereading to teach her book, Reproductive Injustice. And she takes this up in this contemporary moment. What does it mean to foreclose this kind of futurity of, I mean, it's an interesting temporal question because, you know, that Black girls, you know, Black young women are not seen as girls, right? There's a kind of adulthood that's thrust upon them in the way that you talk about boy. That's a really capacious category, whether you're 12 or 60. It's much more about your Blackness, the race, right? And Davis, and by extension, what you're saying about girlhood, it's much more about race and gender than any kind of life stage, right? It's how do you figure into this kind of hierarchy of humanity? So it's interesting to hear you talk about the contemporary implications of it, because it does seem that there continues to be this kind of foreclosure of movement, either forward or backwards. Like you are never just an innocent young, right? Because childhood, girlhood comes with, you know, all these connotations of sort of innocence, youth, experimentation. But all of those things being foreclosed in a lot of ways to Black bodies, I think is an interesting way to think about the work that you've offered us in an earlier period and what we might observe now.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, Black bodies, Black people, Black children, and yeah, colonized people in general who are always kind of like being viewed from the outside. And and assigned a kind of inscrutability, like a humanistic inscrutability in some kind of way. So I just it is important to pay attention to like the different deployments of life stages, like especially at childhood and girlhood in different contexts and different moments in time.
Because of what it might either allow or make possible, right? If you're positioned in a certain way within society, then, I mean, in the way you talked about, then certain forces can act upon you in a beneficent way, right? We are helping you. We are providing care. Whereas,
I mean, we're helping you whether you like it or not.
I was going to say, which is a double-sided coin. This is the care that's going to be thrust upon you almost. So I wanted to ask you, I wanted to sort of circle back to something you said, which is that this project that you're currently engaged in, it sounds like you're trying to track these various empires and the movements of people. And something you said intrigued me, given my own work. You said you're looking at connections, you know, people moving across Africa, the Caribbean, the Americas. And so I wondered, as somebody who works in the Caribbean, if you might maybe just sketch out one of those interesting trajectories, how you see people moving across some of these spaces.
Yeah, so the project is like, it starts in the early 19th century. Mm-hmm. So, and then it goes to the end of the 19th century, basically. Mm-hmm. So it really is starts in a period where there is still a major global slave trading economy. Mm-hmm. And the use of slave labor for production is still very much legal in much of the world, especially like the really rising global economic powers at the time, like in Europe and Britain, France, wherever, Spain, Portugal. So the project goes from that, and by the end of the 19th century, you know, there are a number of like shifts in kind of the global economic system, production systems, the legality of it, the morality, the imaginability of it, you know, the the problem of it. And the Caribbean, I think, is an interesting place because it, well, the Caribbean is very like big and diverse in terms of like what that means. Mm-hmm. But just to give like an example of one of the cases of the circulations that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I was looking at, and I actually have a post on social media about this. I was looking at the case of, so what I'm interested in is about the fact that this is the 19th century and it's in the early 19th century, mm-hmm. where there's still an Atlantic slave trade ongoing. Mm-hmm. And is that Lagos, which is the city that is the focus of my study, mm-hmm. is in the early 19th century, is a place that both is a site of kind of exports into the Atlantic Strait trade, mm-hmm. but also within a couple of, within like a decade or within a generation, is also a site of return or resettlement of people who freed people who had been freed, mm-hmm. and left the Western Hemisphere, so the South America, the Caribbean, etc. Mm-hmm. And this is very peculiar. Not just because the peculiarity, not just because it was very rare for people to be able to, for people to be able or desire or choose to return to Africa, to West Africa, mm-hmm. but also is very peculiar because Lagos's kind of entry as an export site, as a major export site into the Atlantic trade, is very late in the history of the Atlantic trade. So it's like really in the, like by 18, in the early 1800s into 1830s, where already there are some like anti-slave trading bans passed, and
yeah.
there's already like the beginnings of a rollback. So it's, mm-hmm. the entry is very late, mm-hmm. and it is close to the period for of a lot of abolitionist laws.
Yeah.
So it enters very soon before slavery starts to be banned in various places. So you could see that it's so within a lifetime, ostensibly within a lifetime, the entry and exit of Lagos from the Atlantic slave trade can occur within a lifetime. Mm. And in these migration studies that I'm in, these studies of like migrant communities, what you see is that people have the overlap or the mirroring of their life, what I call their life itinerary, hmm. with this history of, you know, the taking off of Atlantic slave trading from Lagos, but also the emergence of Lagos as a free port, as a free city that one could go to. Mm-hmm. So so there's a ship that I was looking at where there's a journey from Cuba to the Caribbean island. And this journey is of a group of freed people who decided that they were going to charter a journey back to West Africa. Mm-hmm. And most of the adults in this group were people who had arrived in Cuba as enslaved people, you know, in their lifetime, and who were now like going back. Mm-hmm. And they, the oldest one was, I think he was maybe in his late 50s. So some of them had, you know, were still, by our modern standards, still quite young to have had this experience. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, you know, the question is like, how do you get from How do you get from the Caribbean island of Cuba? As a person who is able to gain and assert your free status, which is one of the statuses you could have, but it wasn't like entirely protected, you know, so you really had to defend your status. How could you do that and get, you know, to West Africa in the 1840s, to Lagos? And what does that, where does that itinerary flow through? What, how do you pay your way? How long is the journey? How do you, my initial question when I started thinking of the project in general was, given that it's the 19th century, how do you not end up on the wrong ship? How do you not end up on the wrong ship? Like, how do you, and it makes me think of, so there's a lot of information that has to be shared. There's a lot, there are a lot of networks, transnational networks, of information, of safety, of solidarity, of like identification that you're circulating within, you would have to circulate within to make it simply from point A to point B.
And the stakes could not be higher, right?
Yeah, the stakes are quite high. The stakes are well known. And also to make it from, you know, the Spanish Empire into the British emergent British Empire in West Africa, you know, so
there's a there's a linguistic facility that, I mean, there's just a kind of knowing in multiple
there's so
registers.
Much
yeah
there's so much there's so much and so yeah, it's a very interesting case of this particular this particular journey and these particular passengers and the stops they had along the way, the you know, the persistence that they had to have to keep getting to the their intended destination. There's some visual records of it. There's some archival records of their journey. I've been kind of writing about the primary sources a little bit. And I also got creatively inspired because, you know, there's only so much we can know.
Right.
As historians and as, you know, people who want to be historically responsible. But you can also imagine things in a separate genre. So I did some creative writing on that.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, so there are very, you know, very inspiring histories, even in the overall context of imperialism, slavery, racial capitalism as a global system. There, you know, people are amazing. And I think that I'm not trying to romanticize it, but I think that for me, it's important to also attend to those histories.
Yeah, and the possibilities, not the kind of radical anything goes, but the possibilities that remain in the midst of structural, systemic, seeming impossibility. People can
absolutely,
still
absolutely.
I have another question for you. This is so great. At the very start of the conversation, when I was asking about your connection to something as broad as transnational Black feminism, you said it was your intellectual and personal histories that you felt major inclusion makes sense to you. Could you tell me a little bit about your sort of personal history that you think feeds into either the work you're doing or your participation in the group, like your own circuits in the way that makes sense for you to talk about?
Yeah. Well, I think that I have a, basically all my life I've been a migrant of some sort. And I think that can be that experience is very, it's a very interesting position to kind of view the world from. But it's also one that, you know, with acceptance, allows me to imagine relationships that are not bounded by like national membership, national affiliations, national boundaries. And I think that maybe also helps to imagine or understand kind of earlier, like mid 20th century, you know, later 20th century, political groups, political movements of transnational relationship building, transnational affiliation, and the kind of imagination that makes that possible is an imagination that doesn't kind of naturalize that the national boundedness of our identities, that kind of denaturalizes that, and then kind of you open the borders kind of mentally, and begin
open
to
open the borders that, of where one might find solidarity or community.
Relationship and understanding, and open the borders of how one might recognize relationship between what is happening in your local and somebody else's local. So I think that it's not a perspective that is like exclusive to migrants or people who have like a migrant histories, lived histories, but I think it's one that does come with the territory of having a sense of being in and of and linked to multiple places at the same time.
That makes sense. To the extent that you're willing, would you want to chart your itinerary for us, just to kind of give us a sense of your some of your multiple? So we know that you're in New York now, and you're at Barnard College as a professor. Are there moments before that that come to mind as sort of important inflection points in this kind of cultivation of multiple communities that you're talking about?
Yeah, there are. I started out as a baby.
Interesting.
I looked much the same as I do now, very fat cheeks. I started out as a baby. I was born in Lagos, and we're born in Nigeria. But in my early part of my life, my father had a job with the Ministry of External Affairs. And this job, he was like a clerk, and the job required him to move to different offices to work with them. So before age 10, you know, I had lived in Nigeria when I was little. I lived in what was called Zaire, it's now called the DRC, when I was little. And I had lived in Mali as well. And then I moved back to Nigeria, and then we moved to New York. And I think that, you know, those very early years, the constant movement as a child, and the constant like radical, not constant, but, you know, if the entirety of your life is 8 years and you've lived in three different places, it can feel like, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
So you there's like a constant relocation, maybe even a sense of dislocation. But then there's also like you accumulate all these sounds, you know, these different languages, you accumulate all these senses, all these smells, all of these things that you've seen and things that you've tasted. And I was pretty good with languages. So I think the sounds are very important for me. You accumulate all these sounds and you can hear all these sounds. And even if you like forget the actual sounds, like what the sounds mean, I think that the ears, like ability to take in different sounds is like a, maybe like a muscle has been trained in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then we came to the US, and this is probably where I've lived the longest. And I think especially being a Black immigrant in the US, mm-hmm. that, you know, being a Black immigrant, even I think partly with the different statuses, but even maybe not necessarily, that there's a particular experience, because as a Black immigrant, you're kind of, you know, because race is like the fundamental marker in America of everything.
A very binary notion of race too, right? It's not a kind
The binary notion of Black and white.
Yeah.
It's like race and it's like Blackness and whiteness. And mm-hmm. as a Black immigrant, you are part of that binary.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think visibly you're part of that binary. And so in a way, the possibility that you might not be part of the binary of the US at the same time, like you might not be part of the US, is invisible.
Yeah.
It's not like you're like a, you know, eighth generation Asian American who is, because you're not part of the binary, there's like maybe a presumption of your alienness
mm-hmm.
before there's a presumption, before, until proven otherwise. Whereas if you're a Black immigrant, there's like a presumption that you're part of the national binary until proven otherwise.
So you have, this is so funny because it reminds me of what you're saying earlier. You have the not care, you have the expectations thrust upon you, whether you want them or not.
Yeah, you have the expectations thrust upon you, but you also have the membership thrust upon you in a way. You know, it can be rough navigating Black high schools, but it
you're
also
in it. You're in it whether you want to.
You're in it. And I went to this, we moved to this neighboring white town. I went to the high school for one day and I was like, nope. So yeah, it can be, it's not, you know, being Black in America is being a Black immigrant in America, you're jumped into the community in a sense.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, it's all good too. It's both. It's both. It's, there are a lot of, you're jumped into all of it, the negative and the positive.
The fullness of
it. Yeah. So that's a peculiar part of my migration experience too. It's like to be seen as so part of it, but to also know personally that I really was not part of it, and to constantly come across the points of like exclusion really from full national participation.
Yeah.
And I think that but it does get, it did, I think, give me a lot of just a different perspective, a lot of that maybe some Black immigrants might have on like what it is to be in the nation and also excluded from it,
mm-hmm.
Which is the experience of a lot of Black Americans. There's so many dimensions to it, but yes, it's a long itinerary. It's a long story. It's a story for another.
It's a long story. It's been great. I'm glad that we had this version and this chapter of the story. Yeah. Professor George, thank you for taking time to talk with me today. This is wonderful.
Thank you. I love the conversation. Let's continue.